You're not from Seattle. You moved here. Well, no. Tell us how you got here, where you're from.
6 years ago, originally, moved here from Philadelphia. Before that, I lived in Rhode Island, and before that, I lived in Maine, where I grew up. But I was born just north of Chicago in Hoffman Estates, Illinois.
And you studied creative writing in college?
Yeah, so basically after moving to Rhode Island, to Bristol, Rhode Island, which is a small Portuguese town between Newport and Providence, not too far from the Massachusetts border, I attended Roger Williams University and got my BFA in creative writing, double minored in sociology and English literature.
Who'd you study with?
So the professors there were a gaggle of them, most of which I don't really need to talk about. But
how about the top two?
The top two. So one who is dead and one who is alive. The dead one, probably my closest mentor at the school, is Michael Gizzi, who is, you know, telling not only me, but all of his students to wake up. And he was very frustrated with youth, wondering why we weren't throwing sugar into the gas tanks of the Hummers and breaking the windshields of all of the, you know, six-figure vehicles on campus, because it was a really rich school. You know, there was a lot of students from Connecticut and Massachusetts who were attending there and had come from incredibly affluent and economically privileged backgrounds and had no idea. And to be honest, a lot of us, you know, middle class kids also had the veil over our eyes. And so he was trying to reconcile that as someone who had grown up as a working class poet, as, you know, a tree cutter and a manual laborer and also an intellectual. And and he dealt with that. And he kind of guided us. Of course, I don't think anyone actually did do his anarcho activities or his forms of rebellion, but we certainly found rebellion there. We certainly found ways to take advantage of our freedoms and our circumstances and the resources that we had available. You know, I became the music director of the college radio station, WQRI, which was, you know, could be heard in Providence, depending on what neighborhood you were in. And we, myself and several other poets and artists, both of the school and not, would, because I had the power to assign myself the 10 to midnight Saturday night time slot, would go in there, you know, rattled out of our minds on substances, and would just make music and recite poetry, getting complaint calls, getting threats that the FCC would hear about this. You know, there was no censorship. We didn't care. That was the level of energy that we were harnessing. I think it stems back to those mentor figures. In addition to Michael Gizzi, there was Beasley Canost, who is still working there. She is very much a Rhode Island person, but also covers the Midwest and the West fairly extensively in her own writing. You know, I'd never read any works about Oklahomans and kind of the characters that wind up in these strange and disheveled locales in the middle of our country. And that was my first exposure to that through her. Also just a degree of empathy and a degree of personability that really resonated. She was always there in full spectrum, and still is. She's still out there.
How did they recommend that you take this energy into writing? What strategies or subjects did they encourage you to investigate with this notion, this kind of anarcho-leftist kind of notion?
First of all, it was never a political thing. So we weren't talking about politics. We weren't talking about going out and being active, or they weren't trying to convince us to be activists. In a weird way, I think they struggled with that as well, because there was all of those that barrier that existed from all of these students coming from all of these different backgrounds. And how do you judge someone and then kind of assess who they are and place them into a position where you can elevate them? I think that was something that they struggled with. But to go back to your question, it was definitely It was definitely a situation where no one was writing. So these, you have all of these students who end up taking creative writing, the majority of which are, maybe they wrote poetry in high school in their notebooks to keep themselves from, you know, harming themselves or, you know, doing more
going nuts,
doing more extreme self-ostracizing activities. And so you have a lot of students in these creative writing programs, undergrad creative writing programs, who aren't there for the craft. They're not there for that more soulful, you know, heightened way of looking at their relationship with the world of art. And so they're there because they have no other option or because it just seems like the right path. And in some cases, I think for me, arguably, that was, you know, an amazing opportunity, an amazing outlet and doorway into a future world where I could be critical, where I could be free and I could be in tune. But I'm surrounded, if you can imagine, you know, me 10 to 12 years ago, I'm surrounded by other young people that are not giving a shit about anything that they're doing. They're just going to class and they might have written the one poem that was the assignment for that night, you know, go out and sit on the water and, you know, write in the style of Basho or something, you know, like typical assignment. Or you just read Michael Gizzi loved the New American Poets, the anthology. So he would be like, every week we would have to read two of those writers in that anthology and then write poems in the style of them, blah, blah, blah. And so you would have these students that would just go and do the very bare minimum. And then there were students like myself and a handful of others that ended up founding the Student Literary Magazine as well and being involved in that radio programming who... you know, we would write entire books. We would write whole chapbooks for one assignment. Or we would, you know, lock ourselves up in a room and just have dictionaries and encyclopedias and not stop until 4 a.m, you know, high on Adderall or drunk on whiskey. And it ended up becoming this situation where we saw the potential through the motivating presence of these instructors who were like, being able to polarize certain extremes of these extremes of the classroom, and then we found ourselves on the other extreme. Uh-huh. And they would, the instructor would call out, you know, Gizzi would call out those students for being lazy and not caring, and why are they even in this program? There would be entire lectures that would just be completely derailed because he would look at the nihilism and the lethargy and the consumerism of these students with money and you know, their head in the clouds. In the wrong clouds, and he would call them out in class. And then we, in turn, the other students who started to be, not started, but who continued to be really passionate about their work, even at such a young age, we would draw power from that. We would say, oh, look, these other students, the bar is so low in this classroom, so why don't we actually just, like, listen to this lesson and apply it to ourselves? And we did. And
it served as a motivator.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm trying to place the era, so I'm thinking, what was the music that was popular for that radio station at the time?
Oh, goodness. So, yeah, this was 2008, 2007, 2006. That general area. So there was a lot of hip hop. You know, this was coming out on the heels of like Eminem and all of Jay-Z and all of those huge albums that happened right around the turn of the century. So you had a lot of like local hip hop artists like Sage Francis, who were really, really, really bringing a new face to hip hop, also a more diverse face, not only in terms of the race and ethnic backgrounds of the MCs, but also in terms of the content, getting away from the industry, becoming, you mentioned, you know, the anarcho stuff or the political side of things, but having definitely a more mindful attitude towards which music was being written and how it was being shared. Additionally, for me, one of the largest influences I had at the time was Silver Mount Zion Memorial Orchestra, which is this band based out of Montreal, whose members originally were in Godspeed You Black Emperor, which was a huge band in the 90s. It was post-rock, kind of epically long songwriters. And we would listen to Silver Mount Zion over and over and over and over again. You had a lot of folk. You had a lot of kind of like breakout rock bands that were doing things that they had been doing, new things that they had been doing differently in the 80s and 90s. Obviously, for a lot of young white guys at the time, the Mountain Goats were just becoming large, and now it's kind of a cliche to say I like the Mountain Goats, but back then it felt, we didn't have that. There was no like scene around that band, and now they're obviously huge and a lot of people criticize them, but yeah, that was definitely a huge influence as well. And that was a literary influence as well, because mm-hmm. his lyrics are very rooted in literature.
Mm-hmm. Green Day, Strokes, any of those traditional rock bands? Not really. You're wincing. Oh my yeah. God.
So Dookie was the first CD I ever bought, literally. Uh-huh. That was the, and I didn't actually buy it. I, you know, signed up to one of those ads that came to the house. It was like 10 CDs for 10 cents. My mother ended up loving how much debt that accumulated over the next 12 months. But Dookie and Notorious B.I.G. were the first two albums that I ever had access to, Busta Rhymes too. That was back in the early 90s. And I think that once, Green Day had a smattering of really terrible albums after Dookie.
And then American Idiot.
American Idiot happened, but that was on the radio, and that was really popular, but it felt like a super...
commercial.
Yeah, commercialized kind of experience. And not... The symbolic relationship I had with Green Day when I was a kid, when I was, you know, running around the streets of Gorham, Maine... like looking for trees to burn down and stuff. Literally, that didn't happen. Thank God. Don't do that. But that was the kind of music I was listening to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, coming into this space where American Idiot, which obviously had a lot of great power that was associated with awful things happening in the United States and the West, ends up having all these new meanings. And I didn't associate with it as strongly.